Day three is wrap.
Ladies and gentlemen, with that gavel, I have just convened the Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development for February 16th, 2015. We are here at 3 p.m. for the purpose of a continuation of the public hearing on Senate Bill 5520 relating to financial administration of the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. Mr. Chairman, Mr. Director, and others, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Co-Chair and members of the committee. We're happy to be here today. For the record, my name is Rob Patridge. I'm the chair of the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. I'm joined here today by Steve Marks, our executive director, and Bill Schutte. Am I too close to the mic? And Bill Schutte, our one of our analysts internally, and Bill has been doing a double and triple duty as a result of the marijuana and Measure 91 stuff. So if Bill falls asleep in the middle of the presentation, please let me know. I'll nudge him because he's been working
and
a lot.
And why
of
would he be falling asleep?
Because he's working a lot of late nights.
Ah, good. Just checking.
Yeah, not to make sure.
Not the substance of Measure 91. So we're here today to first tell you that you're looking at a very different Oregon Liquor Control Commission than the legislature looked at 2 years ago. You can see the members of the Oregon Liquor Control Commission who are before you. We have had four of the five members of the commission turn over during the time period between the last time you passed our budget and today. We also have a new executive director and Steve Marks, who you've all met. So we have a very, very different organization. We also have some department heads who had been with the OLCC, some of which we're glad to have dragged back in today to be with us today for technical assistance and long-term assistance with the agency. But we've had substantial changes. We had a pretty large bill last legislative session, which legislature took up and was under consideration, and now we have Measure 91. So we're here today. I think we've divided this up.
Mr. Patridge, would you go back to the last picture for just a second? We have new people to Ways and Means, and we have new people to the legislature. Would you give a quick profile of each one of your members, just what they do when they're not helping to manage the Oregon Liquor Control Commission?
Absolutely. The Liquor Control Commission is made up of five members. They're all lay members. Each one of them can't have an interest except one in the alcohol industry that we regulate. Each one of those members represents a congressional district, so that's how it works. Three of those five members can be from the governor's party. The other two cannot be from the governor's party, and one of the reps is an industry rep. I'm the Klamath County District Attorney by day and Liquor Commissioner by night. I don't know if that's good, bad, or indifferent, but I'm happy to be here. I'm happy to be here today to help provide that perspective. The longest standing commissioner is Bob Rice, or Robert Rice, as he's referred to. And Mr. Rice has been on the commission now and served two terms, and is going to be an outgoing commissioner here in the future, but he's a longstanding member of the commission. He's a former Arthur Anderson partner. He is brilliant, to say the least. He is also the restaurant industry representative, and Bob is from the Portland area. Pamela Weatherspoon works for a healthcare organization out of Portland. Pamela is in her 30s and does very well and has provided a great perspective on the commission. She is the second youngest member of the commission. Marvin Raval is our newest member on the commission. Mr. Raval is out of Eugene. He's an insurance person, also has an insurance agency that also is in Portland as well. He's a former retired police officer out of the Springfield and Eugene areas. And then we have Michael Harper. And Michael Harper is out of the Portland area. He's an insurance guy, and if he shows up here, you will notice him because Mr. Harper is a former Portland Trailblazer, so he dwarfs the rest of us in terms of size, and they all provide a great perspective on the commission and have all been very active in what we've been doing to do outreach throughout the state. You may see Commissioner Harper or Commissioner Raval in here at some point in time during the budget process.
Thank you very much. Now, please continue.
All right. Thank you. So we are embracing positive change at the OLCC. As you're quite aware, our mission has been expanded at the will of the Oregon voters during the November election. We have obviously new objectives and new responsibilities. We've spent a lot of time, as we've been able to bring Steve Marks on as our permanent executive director. We were without an executive director for 11 months in terms of somebody filling a permanent role at the OLCC while we did a search. And then in the middle of that, I was asked to be the chair, and the former chair resigned. So we were fortunate, I believe, to have Steve Marks on board to do that. I believe that with Steve's leadership and the leadership that we have at the OLCC, we've strengthened our vision. We do have a strategic plan that we have updated internally, which I think is good, and have had lots of employee participation in helping develop that plan on an ongoing basis and into the future, which the commission has adopted. And we also believe that we've identified some really increased opportunities for the commission and the state, not only for employee development, but also the optimization of revenue as we continue to move forward. As I believe you're aware, the OLCC oversees the sale of alcoholic beverages to allow access for responsible adults while protecting public safety. The agency places emphasis on alcohol sales to minors and visibly intoxicated adults, and that's where a lot of our training and a lot of what we focus our licensing criteria about. We license businesses that sell alcohol. We issue service permits to train alcohol servers. We manage and distribute distilled spirits. I think many of you have toured our warehouse in Milwaukee. If you have not had an opportunity, it would be helpful, and we offer the opportunity for anybody here to come tour that warehouse in Portland. There's some policy option packages which were recommended in the governor's budget, which do address the age and deterioration, I think, of that particular facility. For those of you who've been there, our hearing room was, we came in one morning and it was all flooded out, so we had to move things around because of our roof. So we've got a variety of things.
Mr. Patridge, just so somebody can be getting the answer before it comes up again, I understand that one of the policy option packages is a new roof, and I would like to know about the situation of the HVAC. A nasty rumor is making the rounds in the building that you're going to put a new roof in the same old rusty HVAC, and I just want to make sure you're prepared to answer that question when we get to the policy option package.
We are certainly prepared to answer the question related to air conditioning. Obviously, the governor's recommended budget is what we are here today about, but there's certainly, from an outsider as the chair of the commission, there certainly are some benefits, I believe, as we lift the air conditioner off the roof, not to relift an old decaying one and put it back on the top of the roof. So, and I think you also had some expression by some members of your committee as well that we should be looking at a green roof. So I think we will also get some additional potentially information related to that at some point in time. I don't believe we have that readily available. So there's a variety of things related to our roof that people have asked us about.
This committee
recently
has a keen interest in your roof.
All right. Well, we appreciate that. You know.
Thank you.
It's not a very good grow surface. We want you to know that, however. And we're prohibited from growing.
That's what Senator Monroe thought, the green one.
All right. We manage and distribute distilled spirits. We regulate businesses that sell and serve alcohol. We provide public information about the use of alcohol. We generate revenue essential to services like police, education, and healthcare. I think all of you have received, and we've met with you individually in your offices, information about that, those revenues that come back from the alcohol program into your districts that we hear on multiple occasions may be the third largest revenue source. While it's the third largest revenue source for the state, it's for some local jurisdictions, it's the third largest revenue source in their budget for local government. So administrative hearings unit, we have an administrative hearings unit. Obviously, that's a lot of the work of the OLCC related to hearings, and that's a lot of the work of the commission. We serve as a quasi-judicial body in addition to being a regulatory body, and so we have a hearings unit. We regulate Oregon's bottle bill and the siting of redemption centers. We've had several of those recently, and those are new things that that we've been more and more involved with. And also, obviously, we're going to be involved in the implementation of Measure 91. And I'm sure that as we do the budget this week, and then we're going to have some opportunity to come back and talk to you as your colleagues on the Measure 91 committee make some policy recommendations that probably will impact what our budget looks like and how that's going to get stood up. At this point in time, we have our executive director, who is Steve Marks, who's here. Most of you know Steve, so I won't brag on his background, but we are very, very lucky to have him and his policy and fiscal ability leading the agency. On the public safety side, we have 91 people. Of those, 66 are enforcement officers that are out in our field offices. We have licensing and licensing processors. We have 22 of those. And we have alcohol education, which is three people. On the distilled spirits program, we have 69 people, three of which for purchasing. 58 are involved in the distribution and the warehousing side. Our retail services section, which deals with the agents who are in your communities, have eight. And then we have 248 contract liquor stores throughout the state, and they're representatives of the liquor stores who are here before the committee. In addition to that, we have our support services, which provide a lot of the general services. We have 68 FTE there. We have three in administration. Human resources are four. Financial services at 22. Information services, 15. Government affairs and communications, four. Management consulting and auditing, three. General services and purchasing, eight. And administrative policy and process, nine. I would go back to the government affairs and comms. We don't have four people doing government affairs. Most of that is communications with what goes on and standing up our programs. So,
Mr. Chair, could you speak to the distribution of the enforcement field officers?
Sure. I think we're going to go into a little bit more detail about where our field offices are around the state in a subsequent slide. So if we can cover it then. And there's the next one. So you can see how the OLCC has divided up the state in terms of, it's a little different than our congressional districts, but pretty close thereof. You can see where each of our regional offices is, or where the stars are. And then we have, out of those starred offices, we have the regional office, how it's broken up. There's something else on it. So you can see the areas are Portland, Salem, Eugene, Medford, and Bend, basically, with the eight satellite offices that we have. And I don't know, do we have a slide with the breakdown of each office?
We'll talk about it later in the
cover
the
public
safety program.
Okay. As we said earlier, there are 248 stores within the state. 144 of those are exclusive stores, meaning all they do is basically sell, the core of their business is selling distilled spirits. But there are 104 non-exclusive stores that are in the state. We would tell you, and I know you've been lobbied about non-exclusive stores. We have opened up the ability for stores to opt in to be non-exclusive at this point in time. So that means they can sell not only distilled spirits, but beer and wine. You'll hear from retailers that are going to come in as a result of this that have an interest in making sure that stays in place. But we have certainly opened that up, and we've seen good results for the state. We ran a pilot project for a few years, and we think that that's working out rather well. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Steve Marks.
Just a moment before we have Director Marks. Senator Monroe.
Are those non-exclusive stores primarily in more rural areas?
Co-chairs and Senator Monroe, traditionally those have been in more of the rural areas. But we have opened up the non-exclusive stores, especially around beer and wine, throughout the state. A lot of those have occurred, for example, here in the Salem area and on the coast and in Portland. You're going to find OLCC stores now with a growler station, for example, and selling wine or wine growlers as well. So those are opening in the metro area as much as they were in the rural areas at this point in time.
Okay. Thank you.
Is there an advantage one to the other, Mr. Director? if I were an agent, why would I want to be exclusive versus non-exclusive?
Co-chairs and Senator Johnson, it's certainly, I think it depends on what their retail base is, and we're not forcing anybody to go to their to a non-exclusive license at this point in time. But certainly the stores that have converted, we have seen a financial, the commission has seen a financial advantage, and those stores have produced more revenue as a result for the system. And as a result of that, there are some large economic advantages, we believe, to opening it up, and that's why the commission chose to open it up for any store to apply to be a non-exclusive store. So I think there's advantages for the retailer for sure, and for the agent.
Thank you. Colleagues, any other questions of Mr. Patridge before we move to Mr. Marks?
I think we're actually going to move to Mr. Schutte. I apologize.
Next. Okay. Mr. Schutte, welcome.
Again, for the record, Bill Schutte, I'm the economist for Liquor Control Commission. I'll be jumping in and out as we get to the numbers and, unfortunately, as well as the roof. So I'll be trying to answer your questions on the roof as well. I just wanted to go through our first key performance measure. This is our customer service satisfaction rates. Most agencies have this where we answer six key questions. This is the overall rate. Back in 2014, we achieved a 78% overall satisfaction that judged the agency as good or excellent. The target previous year was 80%, or was raised by the legislature to 85%, so obviously we have some work to do.
Madam Co-Chair?
Co-Chair Gomberg.
Yes, I mean, the question begs itself, who did you tick off in 2009?
2009. So with any of these surveys, they are often often subject to influence by several or one or more stakeholder groups. One of the stakeholder groups we do sample among many is the public. And the public in 2009 overwhelmed our survey with particularly negative comments related to an inspector in the Eastern Oregon area that was in the news both statewide and nationally.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you. Okay, please continue.
Madam Chair, for the record, Steve Marks, Executive Director of OLCC. I'd just add to the Chairman's comments on the exclusive, non-exclusive. As you know, there's a rate differential that we pay within that in that structure. So it's one of the things that agents have been talking about and say disincentive or incentive related to their conversion from exclusive to non-exclusive. So
could you elaborate on that, and could you share any thinking that the agency might have? Because if you move from one to the other with a clear economic benefit in changing your product mix, explain how the disincentive works.
If you switch from exclusive to non-exclusive, we have two parts of our compensation rate structure, sort of base and then variable. The base rate drops when you move to non-exclusive. Now, I think in the history of the organization, they thought that the business acumen of having the additional products of beer and wine would made up for that difference and encouraged it, so they had a great drop in there when you moved. That's been the historical way the formula has operated for quite some time. Having said that, you know, we're in it, and we will talk more about the numbers on retail innovation and the need for upgrading customer convenience in our stores, and we think that the agents believe that they will see some additional investments. And with those investments, there's usually an upgrading of the facilities, their actual stores, in terms of what they do with coolers, arrangements, and the overall atmosphere of the agent store. So we'll cover some of the numbers about our push to satisfy Oregonians' demands for convenience, or show you at least historically where we've slipped from traditional levels of service overall on a per population basis.
Okay. Representative Gumper.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, and thank you, Director Marks. Part of the briefing I received suggested that a potential rule change might be being considered that would facilitate the change from exclusive to non-exclusive.
Boy, we're getting right into this, Madam Chair.
Representative Gongber.
Yes, we would. What we could do is we could accommodate it by rule. This gets into the situation where if we did it under a limitation you gave us that within the governor's budget level, then we would spread to the other agents the actually moving the agents back that have already converted since the pilot program in, what, I believe 2009 it began. So there's a cost differential there. We could do it by rule and spread it within the limitation that we asked. There's no doubt about that.
Thank you. Thank
you. All right. I forgot who's up to bat. I think it's Director Marks.
Going, Madam Chair, Co-Chair Gomberg, as you, Senator Johnson, know, we spent a good deal of time with the interim task force on OLCC. Some of this will be redundant to that, but we had a lot of work done in terms of looking at our partners, our importance to the regulated community that we have in terms of the economy, and our role in both supporting that and regulating that. So some of our primary partners, of course, are breweries, wineries, distilleries, restaurants and bars, and retail stores. Oregon's beer industry is 271 breweries and brew pub licenses strong. The popularity of craft beer continues to grow. Oregon's beer industry employs over around 6,600 employees with a total economic impact getting near $3 billion, $2.8 billion to the Oregon's economy. So an important sector there. The winery industry, even larger. Oregon's wine industry boomed in the 80s and 90s and has gained worldwide notoriety ever since. They're a big contributor to the Oregon economy that now touches, in fact, all counties in Oregon. And incidentally, the grape crop in Oregon is the number one fruit crop now by value. But we have 947 Oregon wineries that are producing here in Oregon, and a very important part of our, not just our revenue stream and sources, which they're probably less of, but particularly the Oregon economy. And I'd note the $3.3 billion that they contribute there as estimate is very, very important. Distilled spirits. Distilled spirits is the emerging new kid on the block. We have 75 licensed Oregon distilleries. It's growing very rapidly in Oregon. A part of our system helps that because we actually can take and distribute their products statewide in our OLCC stores. They now list 500 products with the OLCC. Our local distilleries, including some larger manufacturers, Hood River, comprise 12% of the revenue that we produce for the citizens of the state. And then 63 of these locations are now providing, can sell their products at their distillery by the bottle to customers for home consumption, personal consumption. Now we'll go back to Bill and talk about our measurements.
So as we get into the revenue portion of this and the expenditure portion, one of our other key performance measures, and it's showing up as value, of course, is revenue return spent per dollar invested by the commission. So one of our key performance measures is how much revenue is distributed by the commission per divided by the number amount of expenditures. And in 2014, we distributed $2.93 for every dollar spent by the agency. The ongoing target has been historically $2.70, and in the last 3 years we've been above that target.
Madam Chair, the next few slides in part of our presentation, just to give you context, we're going to look at sort of the big macro numbers around sales, around the budget, about how large it is, and then drill down program by program in the distilled spirits, public safety, and our support services and alcohol program. So you can see that the next slide is the 2015-17 gross revenues You can see on the slide that distilled spirits is 95% of our revenue sources at $1.15 billion. This projection does take into account the overall budget pie takes into account the early projections for the marijuana program. It has it at $16.5 million, which would be 1% of our revenues. I would note that liquor licensing fees are about that 1%, and then the privilege tax on beer and wine contributes about 3% to the overall revenue mix. We are now looking to hit $1.2 billion in 2015-17. This is a overall sort of comparator of past budgets. It does include in the 15-17 the marijuana budget as well with the alcohol budget combined. If you will note, in 15-17, I think the biggest change, I think you could, you know, short of the added marijuana program, short of that, you could, short of our capital investments, you could really characterize our budget as status quo across all other programs. What you see in the column on other funds, non-limited, is $11 million, and that's a new ask. It's in a POP. We're asking that you give us the opportunity to make credit card non-limited accounts, so that's a movement there.
Mr. Marks, yes. I'm going to ask you to stop again. For the benefit of our new colleagues, could you please describe limited and unlimited in the context of the conversation that you're having and what impact that would have on the legislature should we move to unlimited?
Give it a whirl, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Ms. Deister will be here to throw you a lifeline if necessary.
So when we take in revenues, they all go into one pot, the liquor fund. And the liquor fund revenues then are comprised of our costs. And we actually have a graph that will help you get to this little bottle chart that will help you see it down the room. And we take off our cost of, you know, making sure that liquor gets produced and our enforcement costs and our licensing costs out of that. Some of those funds come as limited by you. You say you get $102 million to spend to run your agency. Some are non-limited. What is non-limited? Nothing's non-limited
right
in this
now.
Budget now. So there's been a long-running debate about having non-limited funds here. And non-limited things would be, is it appropriate to have something that's simply the cost of business that we don't control, like credit card fees, being able to be unlimited by the legislature because they're related to the sales we make, they're related to our revenue streams coming in, and they're a part of doing business. So that's what you're asking for, and that's the primary difference there.
Can I jump in here, too? As Rob Hatch, chair of the commission. So our cost of goods sold, the cost of the alcohol, is an unlimited, I think it's an unlimited expenditure on our part. It passes through because we're, you know, it's the cost that we're buying the bottle from the person. So we don't control those, but that's why we're interested in the credit card fee piece potentially, so we don't have to come back to you for a budget limitation on how well the credit card sales went versus the cash sales, basically.
In summary, it provides more flexibility for the agency, some would argue less legislative oversight, but is credit card processing a cost of doing business is where the policy debate resides. Representative Whitsitt.
So is it about 3%? What is the cost associated with credit cards? Is it 1% of?
Yeah. Madam Chair, Representative Whitsitt, is about 1%.
Okay.
If I recall, there'll be a bottle distribution here you will see, and it has the percent up, but I believe it's 1%. Very good.
Okay, please continue.
Just note that from our closed budget, legislatively approved, we're about $18 million up overall for the projections for 15-17, about 28 positions and about 21 FTE. That includes incorporation of the marijuana program. Now, the next slide is specific to alcohol budget and expenditures. These cover the extensive investments into the liquor program. We believe the most important thing we can do is secure the capital investments to be able to meet the demands that Oregon has and to be able to continue to produce stable revenue for you. If you look at the program areas, if you look all the way over to the left across distilled spirits, public safety, support services, and capital improvement, I'd suggest those are the outcomes we are buying with this budget. This is primarily what we're asking you to support above and beyond what we have done in the past and excluding, of course, the marijuana program. DPSST training is one difference, and I think that the legislature had made that decision before about the requirement for additional training. We have begun to train our peace officers at DPSST, and this is the first time we've asked for that in a budget. So it's here and is a policy decision in front of you. But the others are capital investments. Those are primarily what we'll be focused on in addition to what we will be doing now. And we think that's an important choice for us because, you know, we need to preserve the integrity of being able to produce the revenue. I think in subsequent budgets, you will look for these revenues then to shore up other areas of our program, particularly in public safety.
Representative Whitsitt.
So on the DPSST training, this is only for the alcohol part of OLCC, not the marijuana part.
Senator Johnson, Representative Whitsitt, yes, that's true. In fact, we do not have under the ballot measure peace officer authority for marijuana currently. It's a issue that's being debated and one that the commission is recommending for action, but it's not currently a part of ballot measure 91.
Follow up.
Could you describe exactly what those peace officers will be doing, and when they finish that training, will they have the same training as a regular police officer that might be employed by a town or OSP or city or county?
Senator Johnson, Representative Whitsitt, I'll take the first shot at this and then we'll let my DA chair tell you more. The primary difference here is that when they have that status, one, it's not training for law enforcement. We have a specialized program for peace officer training for OLCC now. The curriculum has been developed for that, and we put our first classes through that program here recently. It primarily provides our officers with the opportunity to cite not just for our administrative violations, but for criminal violations as well. Now, that authority on criminal violations is really limited to the discretion and the desires of the commission about how they implement that power on our behalf as an agency. But otherwise, without that, they would have administrative powers, not criminal powers.
Is that responsive?
Follow up. So I'm wondering why, for example, your district attorneys or I don't know if it's a DA, but why someone in your local county or city, if you have a problem, wouldn't be responsible for that. Why you need a whole separate group of people for that?
Senator Johnson and Representative Whitsitt, the OLCC has long had peace officer authority related to making sure that we can enforce our rules under Oregon law, and part of those rules can fall on the criminal side, as well as the seizure of alcohol, some of those kinds of things that we wouldn't have typically under an administrative type of rule as we do today. Today we help supplement local law enforcement jurisdictions throughout the state related to, for example, our minor decoy operations. We go to restaurants and bars and have people under 21 years of age try and purchase alcohol. They're allowed only to give their legitimate driver's license as opposed to some other type of driver's license. So we feel that it's important that they be able to do that and that they be trained. The commission voted several weeks ago related to requesting that the legislature consider that also on the marijuana side, so that we can do that. A lot of local jurisdictions can't spare the officers and time, frankly, to put people out on the street to make sure that the rules are being enforced on a regular basis. We haven't run into problems with local jurisdictions. We always try and partner with our local government partners, certainly in every jurisdiction. We see this as a way to enhance public safety. We're not asking for sworn law enforcement powers, nor do we expect our people to do that. They're not trained to do that. They don't carry firearms. They don't do those kinds of things. But it is a way for us to bridge that difference and that gray area between the what's strictly administrative when that turns into a criminal, which is then handed off to local law enforcement and to do the investigation and do the prosecution.
Okay, just one more follow-up.
So will they be distributed? Each county has a liquor store, or 20 or 30 or whatever. Mm-hmm. So will they be distributed equally through the counties or per ratio of liquor stores in the county to numbers of persons that are trained to do that?
Co-chairs, Senator Johnson, Representative, what's it? Right now, the way the liquor program, we'll show you in later slides exactly how the enforcement mechanism is distributed, but it is distributed on our 8 offices. It's not distributed on an exact formula. It's really distributed on a workload kind of issue, driving distance, for example, in your district, obviously, huge driving distances, and the personnel we need to cover those driving distances in terms of what we feel is okay. What we feel is important. So it's not just a strictly population number or a by liquor store.
Thank you.
Mr. Marks.
Just in closing up the side, you'll notice large percent changes in our budget, particularly around distilled spirits. I just would note that is attributable to primarily the one-time capital expenditures. And I would note with this agency, unlike my other experience around state government, this is not going to be bonded or borrowed. We have cash within our system to be able to make these capital investments. Next slide is our...
I just want to put a fine point on this. You have money within your current budget to do this. This is money that has been budgeted for this specific purpose, or is this happenstance extra revenue? Talk a little bit about your strategic planning in terms of keeping up your physical plant. Having been in the warehouse, that is a facility that calls out for modernization.
Yes, it does, Madam Chair. So, as you know, I've been at the agency a short time, but it's fairly clear that they have not had extensive capital investments inside the agency in many of the base operational systems, including the warehouse, the roof. And, you know, there's always a strong desire to maximize revenues to the general fund, to our local city and county partners when we make appropriations to the OLCC. Having said that, these funds and the revenues go into the liquor fund, and because we're funded off that, we can make the finance opportunity off of the liquor fund to us as part of our cost of business. So that cash exists in the liquor fund. You do need to provide us, however, the limitation for that to occur.
Thank you. Please continue. Well,
and now we have the distribution to the general fund distribution to the general fund in cities and counties. As you see, this biennium we're projected to close out at $442 million. We are on target for that. If we go over that amount, we will have to ask you for additional limitation. That's how the system works, but we don't know right now. We're running right along with our forecast. And then for the next biennium, we're projected to hit $470 million in distributions. And this is the 13-15 projected revenue distribution when the budget finalizes. You see $252 million go to the general fund, $55 million is city revenue sharing, $78 million to incorporated cities, $18 million is distributed to mental health, alcoholism, and drug services, over $600,000 to the Oregon Wine Board, and $39 million to our counties, so for a total of $442 million, as we showed you on the prior slide. Where your liquor dollars go, this is a hand-picked selective list of cities and counties and their current distributions. I would note that it just does not include the revenue sharing dollars that you just saw in the prior chart. But this is important dollars. For Marion County, when the chair and I just met with her and we're talking about how important it was to their budget, it's their third largest revenue source.
Mr. Marks, I was scanning the names of the towns, specifically looking for those that are border towns with our sister state, the state of Washington. And if you could make it, I don't see the kind of graphic display that I was hoping for, but if you could make any kind of a comment with respect to sales at border cities with our sister states, given their current tax structure or their current architecture for sales, private versus controlled.
Madam Chair, sales on the border are booming, and Bill Schutte can give you some exact analysis of that.
Colleagues, I just want to let you know, in the interest of transparency, I've just asked a fairly loaded question, Representative Witt.
Yes, you did.
Representative Witt and I both represent the town of Rainier, and we're quite aware at the end of a bridge, which is generally considered an extension of a city street, what the effect has been. But I'd like you to comment on it, because I think it informs public policy.
Co-Chair Senator Johnson. After the state of Washington went to a privatized liquor system, cost of liquor on average went up about 30%. And the reaction of our stores along the border, specifically the ones that are connected to bridges along the border, was about an overall 36% increase in sales from somebody coming over the border to purchase Oregon liquor, which was so much cheaper. The top gainer of that sales was Rainier, with a 60% plus gain in liquor sales after the 1183. The second biggest one has been Jansen Beach up on the Portland border.
Thank you. For our newest member, the takeaway obviously is the effect of what Washington.
Did legislators get a cut of that?
In my dreams. Please continue with your presentation.
Thank you. So this is our distilled spirits model. It is, so if you look, this is based on a $16 average bottle price for about, that would be about the price of a fifth or a 750 milliliter bottle. So you can see within that, about 4% is OLCC operating expenses. That includes our public services of enforcement, licensing, and administration. 1% is bank card fees. 69% of all purchases in the state are made with bank cards. Some are made with cash, though. The compensation paid to our liquor agents on average is 8.8%. And then you can see our cost of goods running at 49% in the bottom part of the bottle. And then the essentially what profit or the public largesse that's produced by this is 37% of the funds that are granted to the general fund cities and counties.
Mr. Marks, could you comment on the customer convenience aspect of using bank cards? It may well, colleagues, come before this committee to consider having a DMV also have access for customer convenience to the use of credit cards that heretofore has been not allowed. Do you get any feedback from your customers on how much they like or appreciate having a credit card option?
Well, I haven't heard from them much directly. I've been there a short time, but I can say this, that everyone in the agency has heard from them, heard about the need for the convenience. Of course, plastic and credit is very important in today's world with all kinds of different forms of electronic and credit card payment. It certainly is an issue not just in bank card fees and with our agents for the convenience of customers in our contract liquor stores and the agents' contract liquor stores, but it's also an issue for us in our base operations around licensing fees paid to the agency at the counter, and it's an aspect of what you'll see in an investment with our online licensing system to be able to allow online electronic payments.
Mr. Marks, I'm going to ask for your opinion. I am informed that the treasurer negotiates the bank fees on behalf of the state of Oregon. Is that correct?
Yes. Yes.
Would it stand to reason that if transactions at DMV were included, that should the treasurer wish to exercise the option, it would give enormous negotiating leverage in trying to set those fees at a reasonable amount to have both OLCC and the Department of Motor Vehicles have credit card options?
Madam Chair, since you asked for my opinion, I think that that would be true.
Thank you. Okay, please continue.
Next slide here.
You're throwing up those softballs.
The next slide's related to the surcharge, at OLCC. So, for the record, again, I'm Rob Patridge. Currently, there's a 50-cent per bottle surcharge that's been extended by the commission. The commission has the ability to place a surcharge on bottles of distilled spirits. We have a 50-cent surcharge. We did that this year before the governor's recommended budget came out to ensure some stability related to what the legislature's ask was. Consequently, that 50-cent surcharge is expected to generate $33.8 million for this upcoming biennia. That distribution of that income, even though the OLCC levies that surcharge, is up to the legislature in order to determine how those funds are spent. During the last, I keep calling it a special session, but now it's a regular off-year short session, or whatever you want to call it, the OLCC was asked by the legislature to raise above the 50 cents another 25-cent surcharge. The OLCC, as a commission, rejected that. We have one of the higher taxes in the nation related to distilled spirits. We saw what was happening in the Washington experience as well, but we did want to give the legislature stability. That's why we passed the surcharge, the 50-cent surcharge, and that was the determination of the commission ahead of this legislative session.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, for the record, Director Marks again. OLCC broke the $1 billion mark last biennium and is trending upward to the $1.3 billion in gross liquor sales that you see on the graph. There for the that would we expect to hit that mark in our projections in the 15-17 budget. This increase is attributable to, in part, let's try cross-border sales to Washingtonians for one, population increases, people buying up, premiumization of liquor, where they're wanting to buy higher shelf brands, and general increase in the overall popularity of distilled spirits taking place.
Question.
Senator Monroe.
I remember the campaign to privatize in Washington. The folks up there were sold a bill of goods. They were actually told the liquor prices would go down. And as you just said, they've gone up rather considerably. Is there any talk up there about possibly trying to roll back that decision and return to a controlled system?
Co-chairs and Senator Monroe, we haven't heard anything related to that, though the outgoing chair of the Liquor Commission, certainly made a large public statement about it was the worst decision Washington's ever made as she left. We haven't seen that or heard that anywhere from Washington. What we can tell you is we know that a lot of these cross-border sales and interest in liquor in Oregon with the system we have is no matter if you're in Pendleton or Baker City or Klamath Falls or here in the Willamette Valley or in Portland, you have the ability and we have the shelf space to put these distillers and these Oregon grown distilleries on the shelves and make sure they have shelf space in order to make things happen. We have the number one craft distilling industry in the country by all accounts. And part of the reason we do that is because part of the reason we have that is because we are able to distribute those brands and that liquor throughout the state.
Follow up.
So from Oregon's standpoint, we hope they keep the boondoggle going.
Was that a statement or a question?
Yes.
All right, Mr. Patridge, let's move on.
Thank you.
Back to Director Marks here. We're going to be talking now about the programs. We're starting off Appaloosa with the Distilled Spirits Program. The OLCC Distilled Spirits Program prides itself on the great selection that we offer to Oregonians. 1,900 products are regularly stocked in the OLCC warehouse with more than 4,200 items available to Oregon customers. Beyond that, if a product isn't carried by us or listed by us but is available for special order, we will special order it from anywhere across the U.S. that we can receive it from, and we average about 1,800 of those special order sales annually. What I didn't understand, and a part of it came out in this privatization discussion that's been had, what I didn't really understand when I came into this is how truly unique and encompassing our system is in terms of its product selection. You don't see this in other systems across the nation or places in the world. It's remarkably unique in that aspect.
I would just attest to the fact that I asked OLCC to find a special kind of scotch, very, very niche, for a gift, and they found it and were able to very easily and, I think, economically bring it to me. So I validate what you say.
Very good. Continuing on, the public safety program is next. The public safety program is vital to our assurance of ensuring responsible sales and service of alcohol. Make sure that responsible business owners get their licenses, to make sure that people who serve alcohol have gone through alcohol education, and then obviously communicating with our licensees about and local law enforcement and others about the importance of responsible service of liquor.
Director Marks, at one time there was quite a mounting complaint about how long it took to get responsible businesses licensed. What's your lead time? If I open Betsy's Better Burgers tomorrow and I want to sell booze, how long is it going to take me?
I'll look to Bill for preciseness here, but about 75 days, 72 days. We have legislation pending on this. 45 of those days, I believe, are local government review time. So we have stayed, you'll see later, you'll see exactly what our KPM is on this and where we're at.
Thank you.
Just to add, we conduct investigations, public safety issues, tickets and citations, but we do feel that the most valuable work we really do is educating people on the service of alcohol. And if there's one area where we could use an emphasis, it would be on education, and we're starting to try to do that within the agency and how we structure our officers' time. Public safety licensing, it's the first step in public safety, is making sure that responsible businesses are licensed. Our licensing division has issued more than 13,000 licenses in Oregon. 3,500 of those licenses are outside of Oregon. That would include things like direct shippers, wine self-distribution permits, and certificates of approval for beer, wine, and spirits. We also issue, in a very important category, about 5,000 applications for special events like rodeos, fairs, concerts, and festivals. I'm impressed by how important those are to the economy of Oregon. And also that these kind of events, while some are regular and fairly sophisticated operations, others are have less adept folks that are trying to arrange for their alcohol licensing for the first time. We've often responded very speedily and hasty to make sure that we could pull these off for the community and make it work. So I compliment the agency for what I've seen in the time I've been there and their responsiveness to this kind of work. It's comes up, you know, these are frequent part of the little licensing emergencies we have, is to make sure we can pull off some events in some communities. And here you go with the KPM.
Madam Co-Chair, getting to your question exactly, it is a key performance measure of the agency, the average days to process a liquor license. On average, in 2014, it took the agency 76 days to process a license. Keep in mind that a lot of that is allowing local government bodies to comment on a license. They have up to 45 days to do that. Back in 2014, the legislature reduced the target from 90 days down to 75 days. We hit 76 days in 2014. We still don't think that's good enough, and we have some policy option packages and other bills in here that we'll be talking about how we hope to get that down lower.
Next slide. Alcohol service permits. Oregon was the first state in the country to require alcohol service education permits. Today we have more than 143,000 people with alcohol service permits. We expect about a 6.6% increase. A part of this is due to the a new popularity of growlers and growler fill stations. Some of those are going into grocery stores, and there are more service permits that are cited for that. So also generally just the upswing in the economy is contributing to the addition of permits. I would just add, those are annual permits. Working, Bill, was I wrong? Correct me, Bill, if I'm wrong.
Five-year
permit. Sorry, I was concerned. Our liquor licensing, our annual. Working with licensees to achieve compliance through education. They've been standing programs for some time. The agency's had a great deal of experience with these programs. We have the Responsible Vendor Program that's designed to give additional education to employers, employees around alcohol sales to minors. In exchange for being in the program, a business will be able to eligible for reduced sanctions if they do in fact sell to a minor. But it is only applies to sales to minors. The First Call program allows OLCC and public safety staff to have the opportunity to visit with new licensees within 90 days in a educational session on the regulations and what they can do as a business to comply with our structures and rules. It is a safe harbor period. I think this is an area where the OLCC can be particularly helpful to keeping and helping our licensees stay out of trouble, and I like to make sure that we're hitting this mark in the future. I don't have a KPM for you on that, but this is a very important part of our programs. We also provide free ID checking classes in every regional office. And then we also have an extensive fake ID program where we work with security and cashiers on how to spot fake IDs. And this problem is becoming more extensive because of access to fake IDs over the internet, and they can readily be ordered across the internet, multiple licenses. I'm surprised at the sophistication of this fake ID that's available and out there. So we work hard to help our businesses, those on the front lines, learn about how to identify those ID. And then lastly, sometimes in exchange for a reduction of sanction, the commission will require or provide for age verification to be installed in lieu of a fine. So those are some important ways we work with licensees to achieve compliance.
So related to our compliance and education programs, we have another key performance measure, and you'll have to bear with me on this one. It's a little bit of math. But we felt that it was the best way to come up with, those businesses that committed a violation, well, everyone can get caught once. But what percentage of businesses commit a second violation within 2 years of committing the first violation? So our key performance measure was to develop this and found that over the course of the last 8 years that at one time there were about 15 or 18% of businesses that committed a single violation, committed a second violation, and these are serious violations, not just any violations, serious violations, within 2 years of committing the first one. So we've started tracking that. Last year we set a target of 12%. We hit a range in 2014 of 13.1%. As a perspective, of all the premises in Oregon, about 4% had a violation last year. So that's, but we're really focusing on ones that are having problems and trying to either help them or get them out of business one way or another.
Preventing, in the next slide, access of alcohol by minors is our primary mission of the agency. We work cooperatively with businesses, local law enforcement, colleges, universities around the state to address these issues. We've issued hundreds of tickets to minors when possessing alcohol and for consuming alcohol. Our inspectors check thousands of IDs and confiscate more than 1,000 fake IDs each year. So you can see on the chart the data from the violations that were made in 2014 data. Minor decoy operations. For some time now, the OLCC has conducted minor decoy operations. It's one of the tools in our toolbox to make sure our licensees are actually checking ID and preventing the sale of alcohol to minors. We use real minors between the ages of 18 and 20 with their own state-issued ID in the process. And as you'll note, the Oregon driver's license is bordered in red for minors and also has the date they will turn 21 around that border. So the Oregon license is readily identifiable by that.
Preventing sales to minors is a key mission of the agency, and we've developed another key performance measure just for that. Key performance measure that we're seeing here basically shows the percentage of businesses that went through a identification check where a minor decoy went into the business, showed their actual ID, and the rate that they did not sell to that minor. So the good news is that in 2014, 81% of the businesses tested statewide did not sell to a minor. The bad news is that 19% of the businesses did sell to a minor. So we know we have a lot of work to do. Approximately 1,800 businesses are checked every year. And back in 2014, the compliance target rate was raised from 80 to 82%. We just fell under it this year at 81%.
Support services, questions?
Nope.
Support services program is next. Our support services program is more than just our administrative functions. It encompasses our whole quasi-judicial role in sanctions and the administrative law, part of the commission's responsibilities. We also have within that the Oregon Bottle Bill Program, where we are primarily have been responsible for helping to site redemption centers and approve those, but other responsibilities may be coming our way there. And then our fiscal division, I would note, provides extensive services not just to providing for a state budget, but also to mark all of the transactions that take place in essentially our retail business environment in the warehouse.
I want to make sure I understand this, that you just said you have some control over citing the redemption centers for the bottle bill?
Madam Chair, the OLCC has responsibility for final approval of the sites proposed to us under the bottle bill.
I would just note for the record to whoever is listening, I think that when we expanded the bottle bill, that the promise of those geographically diverse redemption centers was made. I think it is an unfulfilled promise at this juncture, and for lots of our constituents, especially, again, for those of us that represent cross-border places, this remains a huge problem. We could take it up in some other venue, but the expectation that there be more redemption centers, I think, was planted and is not coming to fruition.
So. Madam Chair, if I may, I have several concerns with our future with that program and the extent of work that it's providing. Right now, we use part of a person in our case managers for our administrative law functions. I think we're going to get more and more conflicts and responsibilities around here, and the issues about siting became clear to me when there was a proposal for the downtown metropolitan area drawn on sort of with urban expectations on the radius of its service area. So, you know, there's differences between rural Oregon and metropolitan Oregon. I think it requires a more extensive planning and economic consideration going forward, and if we're going to be an extensive part of that, we're going to be looking to you, I think, to discuss that with future legislation in particular in mind.
Thank you for pointing that out. Okay, go ahead.
I just noted our financial services division. I just wanted to note for Co-Chair Johnson that you, when you served on the interim task force, you admonished me not to do one thing. And that was to lose Michael O'Connor, our budget director. Michael has since retired, so I failed miserably in that regard. He is here on contract helping shepherd our budget through, and I want you to know that, as you saw during those presentations, Michael carried this agency through a 25 gold stars audits and 20 years of five-year gold star.
He's done
star
really
audits.
Well.
Yeah. Incredible service to the state. It would be a tremendous loss to the agency, and I happily report on the outcome of your direction.
Budget's dead. Go ahead.
And now we're going to look forward to our investments, our future, how we move forward. And with that, Bill Schutte has done extensive work around the case presentations for the warehouse, for the roof. I'll carry a part of that, but that's the next segment here.
Mr. Schutte.
Again, Bill Schutte for the record, economist for the Liquor Commission. I just want to present some of the results we've done. We've had numerous retail innovations, task forces, fact-finding, and so from that we're trying to formulate a strategy moving forward, basically what your budget is going to buy. So one of the things that came out of this is, are there enough liquor outlets in the state of Oregon? And one of the answers is maybe not. But beyond that, we also are looking for other opportunities for retail expansion, including relocating stores, allowing stores to sell more products, bigger stores, more modern stores. But beyond the retail expansion itself, we still feel that investment is going to be needed to meet the increase in demand for distilled spirits, as Director Marks back pointed out. Increasing population, increasing popularity for distilled spirits. We're actually getting some replacement spirits or puncturing the beer and wine markets, mostly the beer markets. There is an increase in demand for higher-end spirits. The bourbon trend is going strong. I think the last time we were up here, the vodka trend was going strong, but now it's higher-end spirits, primarily bourbon and whiskeys. And, of course, the continuing demand of cross-border sales from the state of Washington and other states. So looking at the need, if any, for new outlets, this is a graph of the liquor store, number of liquor stores historically going back to 1970 in the state of Oregon. And as you can see, there was a climb from 1970 about to the mid-80s. The last state-run store closed, and it went to a contract system in about 1983-84. And then we see a general leveling off with some more recent climb in the 2000s. And so it kind of points to an issue that maybe, you know, what does this really mean? But so to really get to, are there enough stores? what's the population per liquor store history. And so this graph shows a fairly constant population of about one store per 12,000, again through the 1980s, but then a rise in rate until the current out rate of about one store per 16,000 in 2014. In order to meet that 1980 ratio, we would have had to add about 75 additional outlets over the last 30-some years, which haven't been added.
And have you done any modeling to show the effect on the current 250? The more times you slice the pie, the lesser it could be for everybody. If I owned a liquor store, I think I would be quite concerned that you would flood the market with too many stores. Any interaction with agents on that or any modeling about it?
Co-Chair Johnson, yes, we have done some more, I guess, actual data on that. When we know that when a liquor store is open in a district that surrounding agents do take a hit, that hit can vary depending on the agent and their own capability and their own stores. Battle Creek, I think, was the last one in Salem. And that agent, I think, took about a 15 or 20% hit. I don't have that number exactly on the tip of my tongue here. But overall, the system grows over. So all the stores over the longer period of time will grow and eventually will gain more than what the original agent lost. So that is a consideration that we have to do, and I'll talk a little bit about on their strategies, is that if we are to expand a number of outlets in the store, what is the impact on existing agents? So that is a primary consideration for us.
Mr. Marks.
And Chair, if I may, this is an important question. You know, for us to be successful in meeting this customer convenience thing, we're going to have to work extensively with the agents to make that work. But we want to balance out both getting the bang for the buck and the change in customer convenience with our agent structure. So how we analyze that and work through those consequences that we know are real throughout the state are important. On the other hand, I would just point out, and I pointed out to our agent structure, you know, how much growth are you entitled to by having one of our contract stores? And that's a balance of equity in the system. And we think there is room for new entrants. But we have to work very, very closely with our existing agents to balance that out and make it right.
Thank you. Mr. Schutte, please continue.
Again, Oregon's comparison to other states and a national average as far as number of stores per capita or per population per store. Oregon's average is rounded up to about one store per 16,000. The national average for all 50 states in the District of Columbia is about one store per 4,500. And the average for control states, there are 17 control states similar to Oregon where the state controls a part of the system. Most of them control at least the warehousing and retail parts of it, the liquor system. That average is one store per 8,400. So we realize that we are behind the rest of the nation as far as the number of outlets. And we've heard that from the industry repeatedly as well. So moving forward, we want to look at a market-based approach for this as to how, you know, determine the number of stores. You know, is it just the number of stores? Is it the types of stores we have? So looking at that, we want to improve the customer experience by approving store conversions that do allow beer and wine sales. We've talked about that previously. We want to encourage relocations and remodels we can of the existing store system. There's been consistent evidence that when a store remodels, there is dramatic, or relocates are often dramatic increases in sales, up to 25 to 35% sometimes. And we also want to look at improve the business agent business model for profitability. Part of our data gathering with our industry partners has been to look at the if we were to increase the number of stores, identifying those underserved areas within the state. We are in the process of gathering that data and identifying those areas now. But even beyond that, maybe to develop a new process for liquor store appointments. And then again, for the existing stores, to help the existing agents, we're also cooperating with the agency to improve self-management, shelf management of existing stores. Are they carrying the right product mix for the areas that they're in? So the tools for those expansion we're looking at include working with the agents for system governments. Our agents are an essential partner in this expansion. We also realize that we have to differentiate from the rural from the urban stores. We are implementing a training for agents and staff. There is one scheduled for March, an all agents training that will bring in industry experts, talk about products, talk about self-shelving, how to sell product, talk about how to use data for their own purposes of selling product, and many other type of aspects to help them with the retail experience.
Is that free to the agents?
Yes.
Thank you.
We are also looking at the type of contracts. There is one standard contract for pretty much every liquor store in the state, but there are different types of liquor stores in the state. So we're evaluating the type, the length of the contract. The average length of a contract now, and for most of them, is 10 years. Is that appropriate now, given a new retail environment? Service requirements and their own return on investment. And as always comes up every session is agents' compensation. Can we design incentives for investment and growth that not only benefit the agents but also benefit the state of Oregon as well? And as I mentioned before, we are working with the industry heavily now for analytics. They have analytical departments around spirits and sales that are much superior to ours, and so they have volunteered some of their services to identify areas for expansion if we want to go that route into different areas, but also the shelf management of existing agencies. Are they carrying the right products? Are they serving the right demographics out there? And then finally, if we go through with expansion, increasing the warehouse shipping capacity, and we'll talk about that more in detail. So as part of this expansion of the retail experience, investments into the OLCC, this is a summary slide of our policy option packages. These are asked for beyond the current service level. These are the descriptions. I'll get to the amounts in the next slide. The biggest one is POP 104. The OLCC warehouse has reached its capacity for outgoing shipments and is at risk of not meeting consumer demand. I'll talk much more about that one. The solution is to increase the single door shipping system to a multi-door, up to five door shipping system by upgrading the conveyor system and allowing sortation. I'll talk about what sortation actually is. The second POP is the roof repairs of our aging facilities built in 1954. 1977 are endangering health and safety of employees, putting distilled product at risk. We're asking for funds to replace the roof over Millport Warehouse, which is about a little less than a mile up the road from our McLaughlin facility, and a phased replacement of our roof over the McLaughlin complex. And then smaller ask, online POP is to look at our online liquor system, develop an online liquor licensing system to keep up with customer expectations that will allow us to accept payments with credit cards online. And then not a POP, but it is a bill sponsored by the commission, House Bill 2480, that will establish a liquor license application fee of $150. Problem we're running into is we see some licensees that are unprepared or uncommitted to the license applicants. This can slow down the licensing process. Solution is to establish a fee that gives them more investment in the system and helps some funding for some of the upgrades, such as the liquor licensing payment system. These are the amounts of those policy option packages. The largest one, of course, is the warehouse shipping capacity upgrade of a little over $5 million. The repair of roof facilities of $2.6 million. I'll talk about the HVAC units when we talk about the roof. And then smaller ones, we'll look into an outside contractor to help us do the e-commerce for the online licensing and payment. And then the training for the DPSST. Through the academy here in Salem, $250,000, and then upgrading our 1991 phone system is as well.
Where's that perennial favorite, that dog of a computer system you've got?
You want to give her the good news? Or?
Go ahead.
I believe that, I wish Mr. Hall, our IT director, was here, but I believe that we are within months, maybe 1 month, of getting off the COBOL system. So we will hopefully, we will have a party, and we will invite everybody when we get off our old cobalt system.
Do you know where we can get the liquor for the party? go ahead, please.
Madam Chair, we did not bring down our mission critical typewriter, but as you know, we have still use a typewriter in the agency to put the life history of a premises on a 5x7 card from the beginning of existence in Prohibition until now. We're be moving, once we get out of COBOL, we'll rapidly be moving to digitize all our files.
Colleagues, we have 4 minutes until the conclusion of the committee. We have about 20 pages left to go. If this is a natural breaking spot, I'm going to suggest that we break here, and when we return tomorrow, we will be cutting into marijuana's time on the stage, but that we would expeditiously go through the last of your slides and then move into marijuana. Is that agreeable, Mr. Co-Chair?
Yes, Senator Johnson, you're suggesting we stay out of the weeds tomorrow and focus?
I'm saying we postpone going into the weeds tomorrow.
Okay.
Any questions or comments before we conclude for today? Any closing comments?
Madam Chair, what's a typewriter?
Senator Witz, I mean Representative Witzit will explain it to you. They're not kidding. This computer system, the last time I was out there, I asked them to just pull a paper record out, and they pulled a 1939 record for the Bend Elks out. Chair Patridge, were you intending on being here tomorrow anyway? I want to accommodate your travel schedule back to Quamaw Falls.
Senator Johnson, I will be here tomorrow for the committee hearing,
okay.
For your budget hearing.
All right. Anything else, then, for the good of the order? Thank you very much for your presentation. We're adjourned. Order. Thank you very much for your presentation.